Hold on, I'm eating chips. This is making great audio.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Greetings, as always. This is Dan Godby, medical editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for the winter edition of the JSOM podcast. For this introduction, I won't mention any specific articles as I've done in the past, but will emphasize that, in addition to the articles covered by Josh and Alex in the podcast, there are many other articles well worth reading in this winter edition. Several on airway management, a few on simulation and its effect on training, and some after-action reports. All provide good information that can be used by operations, training, and field personnel. We at the JSOM are always interested in hearing from our readership. Please send us your articles, and we will do everything we can to work with you on getting your article to its best possible status, especially those of you in the primary positions. And I'd like to reiterate our mentoring program specifically created to help medics get through the publishing process. A select group of editors are dedicated to concentrate on articles submitted by medics and provide assistance in getting them published. Now, here's Alex and Josh with the podcast.
Hey, brother, it's been a while. We're still in different time zones, still sometimes doing interesting things. How's life been for you these days?
I mean, when's the last time? We haven't been in the same time zone since we were in the fellowship together, man. Like, it's been many.
Remember, we did our little bromance picture at the East Conference with Stacey Shackelford a couple months after that.
That's true. We were also together at the Society for Army PAs conference.
Oh, yeah.
Last year, I think, right?
Yeah. It's been a while though.
I'm doing all right, man. It's going well over here. It's not really all that cold here where I'm at, even though it's almost Christmas time. But that's okay.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, you know, on to more interesting things. I actually recently had a patient encounter that wasn't a good patient encounter, but certainly had a lot of good takeaway points. And it was, we were supporting some of our soft customers in an austere environment. And lo and behold, there was a case of Montezuma's revenge that went through the camp, as it is wont to do on a regular basis. Yeah, medics are good at many things, diarrhea being one of them. And, you know, it comes and goes in waves, as does the nausea and vomiting. And it really cleared through everybody in camp except one particular service member who just had an enduring presence of Montezuma in his life. And this was despite getting basically everything in the Trop Med handbook thrown at him in terms of antibiosis. You know, after the fact, it brought to mind kind of having an algorithmic approach to most everything in medicine. And I don't know about you, but the way I like to approach a lot of these workups is in a similar thought process. And certainly from a surgical perspective, I don't know about you, but the first differential diagnosis I always think about whenever the ER calls to consult us is cancer. Right. So cancer is my number one. And then usually, which is the most severe, but not the most frequent. And then after that is infection. And it's always nice to remember the different types of infection, because I don't know about you, but when I was young, it was always thinking about what bacteria it is. But we've always got more than that that should be on our differential, including viri, parasites, and amoeba. And then, of course, the fungi that can occasionally get in there.
Having seen especially what fungus can do to people, it's quite dramatic, and it is quite traumatic to watch. So yeah, it's definitely something that's got to be on top of mind.
Oh, I know exactly what patient you're talking about. I don't think either of us are going to forget that fun guy.
Mm-mm.
But you know, in addition to cancer and infection, kind of my standard workup then in terms of acute pathologies is usually ischemia for whatever etiology, whether it be a vasculopathy or infection or potentially even embolism, crush, all those things that can just cause your body to not get blood flow. And then the one that I forget about, of course, is autoimmune pathologies. And is there any other big category that you often think about?
No, I think that that covers the gambit, especially when you're being consulted by the emergency department. And, you know, you got to remember that the emergency department is really good at finding appropriate people and knowing where they need to be dispo. And then it's our job to continue that workup to make sure that we haven't missed anything that isn't top of mind, because it's not something you see every day.
Yeah, exactly. And in this particular case, this individual did indeed join Montezuma's party and have an infectious diarrheal etiology. But what we didn't catch is that that then triggered his underlying autoimmune process that as a young 20-ish year old service member he'd never experienced before, and put him into an autoimmune GI flare that then subsequently required pretty extensive, invasive, and life-altering surgery down the road. So anyway, that's a little free chicken on kind of ways to think about working up acute pathologies for the less than exciting DNBI patient that you see in the austere environment.
I mean, remember, the DNBI is the most common, is what we most commonly see. We talk about trauma, we talk about surgery, but DNBI is the bulk of our workload. And so I think that's a really good primer and discussion on remembering that DNBI is important, and sometimes DNBI can be herald of something bigger. It's not always just diarrhea. Sometimes it's diarrhea and. So keep your eyes and ears open.
Moving on to more than just our prognostication about our failures doing surgery and taking care of patients, let's talk about some articles. What have you got for us this month?
Yeah, so the first article we're going to review is Airway and Hypothermia Prevention and Treatment via STEAM, the System for Thermogenic Emergency Airway Management. And this is authored by Dr. Ryan Stevens, Dr. Bradley Pierce et al. Out of the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. And so these authors wanted to take a look at hypothermia and airway specifically, because in the future, as we have to deal with more LISCO environments, prolonged casualty care, less ability to move patients in and out, we have to deal with the areas of trauma that we may not have to have dealt with when we only had them for an hour. Most importantly, hypothermia. Hypothermia makes the coagulopathy of trauma much worse. And so getting in early and making sure that patient stays warm is very important. And they discuss that very extensively in their introduction. One area they feel that has not been appropriately addressed is the warming and humidification of oxygen provided to the patient if they're endotracheally intubated. And they state in their paper that there is some concern that when you remove the upper airway by passing an endotracheal tube, that you will lose that warming and humidifying effect, and that will have a deleterious effect on patient outcomes. So they identify that as the gap they're trying to look at. They have designed a new device called the System for Thermogenic and Emergency Airway Management, or STEAM. They've designed this device, but it doesn't appear by reading this paper whether or not they've actually built it out. And they suggest and they put forward that this device will be able to overcome that particular area of warming and humidifying oxygen delivered to the patient. And they've also stated that it's fairly small, it's battery powered, and that it has many safeguards in place in order to make sure that we're not burning patients' airways. And that's the limit of this article right now. There are no tests with this particular device. It appears that they haven't made it as of the submission date of this particular paper, and they haven't tested out on any subjects. So right now it's sort of more just a theoretical, you know, this is what we think we'll be able to do with this particular device. Reading through sort of their introduction and their review of the literature, I didn't see any articles specifically, but I wonder if patients who have received all of the appropriate warming treatments that we have in our current arsenal that are available at the Role 1, if these patients will be actually harmed by not using this device, by not having warmed oxygen, because I don't see any literature to support that this one device will make the difference in a patient. having warm humidified oxygen is a benefit. They are trying to fill a gap that they see in our current capabilities. But as of yet, this is still just an idea that hasn't been tested. And I don't really know if there is currently an actual gap based on the literature that we have. What do you think, Alex?
So my concern is with this article, kind of the ongoing, I think, disconnect between people who are in a CT environment and trying to apply it to LISCO, which is when they make the argument that we're going to be sitting on patients for a prolonged period of time in a LISCO environment, they then try to come up with these really expensive, fancy doodad gadgets that probably aren't going to work. And nobody really appears to be talking much about how we're going to be sitting on these patients for hours to days, but we will also be trying to manage them and 5,000 of their nearest and dearest critically injured friends together. And it seems like most of the med planners have realistic expectations about our ability to meaningfully provide high quality care for these folks, which is to say, there's probably going to be a significant emphasis on comfort care and our ability, despite being critical care fellowship trained providers, is going to be limited simply by the sheer number of critically ill patients. And I don't know that a fancy widget that may or may not work is going to make much of a difference. And very excited for this edition, as always, to have a guest editor. And Devin, thanks so much for your time and insight. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, really a privilege and a pleasure to have somebody of your scope and caliber joining us today to share your insight. And for those folks out there that you haven't had the opportunity to work with in the past, maybe you could give us a little bit of insight about your past experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Second Lieutenant Devin DeFeo, enlisted in the Army in 2004. I served as an 18 Delta for Special Forces Group in USASOC. Yeah, I then went on to the enlisted medical degree program at George Mason University, earning my master's in biology. Right now, I'm a third-year medical student at the Uniformed Services University, or USHIS, considering a residency in emergency medicine right now.
Awesome. And it is so great to have somebody like you with both operational experience as well as some fresh eyes and insight into some biostatistics and all that sort of stuff that gives most of us a bleeding out of our ears. So jumping right into the article, what have you got for us today?
Yeah, so the article we'll be reviewing is titled, "Does Mental and Visual Skills Training Improve High-Value Target Identification and Marksmanship Amongst Elite Soldiers?" by J.J. Dawes et al. This paper, pretty interesting, took mental and visual skills training, or MVST, which has been shown to enhance sport performance in high-level athletes, and looked to see if this was applicable to training soft soldiers. And of note, MVST has been shown to increase things like response speed, discretion, and accuracy, something very relevant to soft training.
And before we get into our analysis, maybe you could help some of us out there by giving a little bit of an insight about what MVST is.
Yeah. In a nutshell, there's like a mental component and a visual skills training component. The authors didn't exactly explain what these drills were in their paper, but if you're interested, you can read the paper to understand a little bit better, or you can do what I did, go on YouTube and watch some videos of visual skills training and that sort of thing.
Always helpful. And for this manuscript, what did you identify was the gap in literature that the authors were attempting to clear up?
Yeah, absolutely. So the authors hypothesized with their null hypothesis that there would be no significant mean difference between MVST users and non-users on the high-value target identification and marksmanship task. What they did is they did a retrospective cohort study, which was IRB approved. They analyzed de-identified archival data from 52 SOF operators. Their ages ranged from roughly 27 to 35 years old. In this sample, there's 15 self-reported users and 37 self-reported non-users. They were assessed with that HVTM, or the high-value target marksmanship task, after they completed a cephalic stress shoot. And what this involved was basically could they recognize, accurately shoot at the correct target, and score a kill shot or be precise in the test. They took the data from the target marksmanship task and analyzed it via independent t-test to determine a significance of a mean score difference with a p-value of less than 0.05. Furthermore, they did a Cohen's D, that's D for delta, effect size calculation to determine the magnitude of difference between the groups on the MVTM task with regards to the variables of age, overall score, positive recognitions, shot accuracy, shot precision, and time to engagement.
And what did they find?
Bottom line, Alex, the authors failed to reject their null hypothesis because they did not find a statistically significant difference in performance. However, the numbers did show a small effect size between the user and non-user groups of the MVST. So in all categories, the users found a small to moderate effect size. And of most interest to me was the fact that the users were almost a half second faster than non-users and more accurate on average. And overall, the authors concluded that these results have potential implications for both elite and conventional soldiers, as well as other tactical occupations. Even though they're not statistically significant, they think that this still may be worthwhile and can give small advantages for in the context of something that's high stakes.
Well, thanks for that great summary of the manuscript. And now moving on to your analysis, as with every paper, there are strengths and weaknesses. Did you have any identified strengths from this paper?
Yeah, first of all, I thought the paper was pretty relevant. I mean, soft operators are elite athletes, and they're always searching for a way to improve their performance. MVST may just be that edge. And I think it gives commanders and instructors something to think about with, you know, how to tweak training for the greatest benefit. Secondly, they use that standardized mean difference, or the Cohen's D that I described earlier. Oftentimes, p-values are seen as an end-all be-all of a study's results with regards to its worth. But here, you know, that tends to discount the context with which the study relates to the real world. And I think here, you know, any gunfighter is going to tell you they'd like to be a half second faster than their enemy on the trigger. So I think it's a pretty strong strength there.
Fair enough. And then, as with all manuscripts, there are certainly weaknesses or opportunities to improve. Did you identify any of those today?
Absolutely. At first, the sample size of that they use, researchers use, was pretty small. They also didn't standardize the time spent using MVST for the users. And furthermore, the two groups were also disproportionately sized, which, you know, the authors acknowledged all this. And they realized that, you know, more research is needed to really come up with promising results that may change or, you know, indicate further applicability of this. I would suggest that in the future, the researchers consider randomizing the groups or using a crossover design study that would allow each participant to act as their own control. Furthermore, I wanted to know what the researchers did to remove confounders. For instance, you know, did they use the same rifle or did they use pistols? Were all the optics standardized across the board? Some stuff that I was wondering. And lastly, the standardized mean difference that they use, the Cohen's D calculation, has been known to cause overinflation of results in small sample sizes. And maybe they could have, I didn't know through their write-up of their methods if a correction factor was utilized or if they could have used maybe something called a Hedges G, which would have been more appropriate possibly in this setting.
Yeah, what a great analysis. Thanks. And so do you think this study meets the requirements to change clinical practice?
I would have reservations, requiring MVST to be implemented in a soldier's combat training based on these results. The fact is, it's an outcome research study with a level of evidence of 2C, so not something that we usually change clinical practice based on. But I think considering the strengths and weaknesses mentioned above, I would maybe offer this as something people could do on the side and for each soldier to determine, you know, what they think would be most helpful for them, but I wouldn't implement this on a wide scale.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time and insight. Again, it's always a privilege and a pleasure to get to chat with folks like you who are a very small sample size yourself of having both the operational experience and the academic chomps to really cover a lot of these manuscripts for us. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Alex. Really appreciate yours.
Wounded Warrior Project's mission is to transform the way America's injured veterans are empowered, employed, and engaged in our communities through a variety of free programs and services. One of those programs is Warrior Care Network, which aims to minimize the impact of mental health issues on everyday life. Through a partnership with four top academic medical centers around the country, participants receive a year's worth of evidence-based treatments with complementary alternative therapies during a 2 to 3 week intensive outpatient program. Please visit warriorcarenetwork.org to learn more.
And finally, for our deep dive article, we have an exploratory comparison of water-tamped and untamped explosive breaches, practical applications for the tactical community via a pilot study, with authors Dr. Kamamori et al. From the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. What the authors noted in their abstract was the gap analysis that they found was tamping explosive charges used by breachers is an increasingly common technique. The ability to increase the directional effectiveness of the charge used, combined with the potential to reduce experienced overpressure on breachers, makes tamping a desirable tool from an efficiency standpoint for breachers, but also a safety standpoint for operational personnel. The consequences of long-term blast exposure is an open question and may be associated with temporary performance deficits and negative health symptomatology. The defined purpose in the paper was working to evaluate breaches of varying charge weights, material breached, and tamping device used to determine the value of tamping during various scenarios by measuring actual breaches conducted during military and law enforcement trainings for efficiency and blast overpressure on operators. The methods used included 3 data collections across 18 charges of various construction that were evaluated with blast overpressure sensors at various distances and locations where breachers would be located to assess explosive forces on human personnel engaged in breaching activities. Their results found that water tamping is a benefit on moderate and heavy charges, but offers less benefit at low charge to mitigate blast overpressure on breachers. Reduced overpressure allows operators to stage closer to explosives and lowers the potential for compromised reaction time. It also reduces the likelihood of negative consequences that can result from excessive overpressure exposure and allow operators to do more with less material in complex environments where resource access may be limited by logistic or other limitations. They do go on to note, however, that tamping in all instances improved blast efficiency in creating successful breaches, and they end by stating that implications and future direction are discussed in the paper. So, Josh, which of the assessment tools will we be using for this paper today?
So, Alex, we will be using the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine's University of Oxford's therapy study checklist. So, the first question, was the assignment of patients to treatments randomized?
Well, in this case, our patients were doors that got pulverized by explosives. And I don't recall them being randomly assigned. I think this was a convenient sample for ongoing training, if I remember correctly. Does that sound right?
I think you're about right, yeah. I'm just sort of picturing doors, like going up to the door and like and just like sticking an envelope on it on each one and just being like, you know, having to open the envelope and then, you know, trying to randomize against the door like an inanimate object. Like, geez.
No, little Timmy's going to get blown up. Do you have to put like sticky googly eyes on the doors?
Yeah,
to make
exactly.
Them
like, yeah. Put a set of cane on one of the doorknobs just to sort of give it a semblance of age. Jeez. Oh, God. Anyways, were the groups similar at the start of the trial?
Yeah, it appears to me that they tried to do some A-B testing within their sample populations. Is that how you read it?
Yeah, I guess it depends on, like, going back to the first question, are the groups the doors or are the groups the sensors? Or are the groups the... I don't think the groups are the explosives. So I agree with you. I think they did a good job keeping the group similar at the start of the trial.
Yeah, so from the biostats perspective, remind me, which one was the dependent variable and which one was the independent variable?
Oh, Alex, because
one's the door and one's the explosive.
Don't do that to me. I believe that the door would be the dependent variable since the independent variable is the explosives and its action upon the door.
All right, next question.
Aside from the allocated treatment, were groups treated equally?
I think that's a hard question to answer for this particular data set. How would you approach that question?
Well, I mean, so again, like the groups, we've got to say, are the groups the pressure sensors or are the groups the doors? I mean, the doors, they talk about a couple of them not being hung appropriately and stuff like that. Because the allocated treatment, I think, is the actual action of the explosive on the door and whether or not it was tamped or untamped. So yeah, if you look at the sensors, I think the sensors were treated equally. I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah. Well, and I apologize in advance for any of the three listeners left who are listening to us do a terrible job assessing our scientific literature that we're supposed to be good at. But, you know, if you go, as one should, to the last sentence of their introductory paragraph, they do an awesome job of specifically delineating their hypothesis. And again, just from a stealing methods from smarter people, I would encourage future authors to look at how they did this. And they put their null hypothesis and their alternative hypothesis very explicitly down there. And what they said is water tamping will increase breaching success rate from blasts of the same construction on the same target type. So I think their dependent variable would be the blast on the door and their independent would be water tamping versus not water tamping. Does that sound right?
I think, yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, their method of measurement was definitely like the pressure sensors themselves.
All right, what's the next question?
Were all patients who entered the trial accounted for, and were they analyzed in the groups for which they were randomized?
Well, again, now that we've determined, based on their excellently written introductory paragraph, that their patients were the doors, yeah, I think so.
I agree. And then lastly, were measures objective, or were the patients and clinicians kept blind to which treatment was being received?
Again, in reading through the study in their methods, they determined ahead of time what they were going to determine as a successful versus non-successful breach. And so there, I think, was not much in the way of subjectiveness to determine a successful versus unsuccessful. So I do think that it was objectively determined ahead of the study, which is, again, exactly what we look for in a good study.
How large was the treatment effect?
You know, unfortunately, this is a pretty small data set, and so that was not assessed.
So what was the measure, and then what does it mean?
Yeah, as previously delineated, they established specific criteria ahead of time objectively about what a successful versus unsuccessful breach would be, and I'm going to refer any interested listeners to the paper itself to see that.
How precise was the estimate of treatment effect?
It appeared as precise as it could be, again, given the previous answer.
And now for everybody's favorite question when it comes to explosive and doors, will the results help me in caring for my patient?
I absolutely need to start incorporating explosives in caring for my patient.
But tamp them. Tamp them first. You have to tamp them.
In days of yore, when you were doing family medicine, like I did several decades ago, did you ever have to do a serum and disinfection? Because that is absolutely a place for some blast. And to answer some of our questions, we actually have the privilege of one of the authors of this interesting manuscript, and really excited to chat a little bit more with you about your submission. Thanks so much for joining us, Mike.
Oh, pleasure is mine. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Ignoto, we don't often get PhD doctors on the show, since we're usually more focused on MD. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your academic focus and how you came to be involved with this project.
Absolutely. So my road was a pretty non-linear one.
My area of focus is communication science, which is social science methodology. So I work on mostly building a lot of measures, ways of assessing, and different evaluation structures of human interaction. I, as a grad student, way back when I was a young man, was never really that interested in the nice side of human interaction. I focused most of my attention on preventing tragedy and dealing with risk. So I would focus a lot on interdiction and identification of spree killers. I would look at different projects that supported various elements of target identification for the Air Force. I ended up working in a counterterrorism research center for a few years, looking at weapons identification, developing different strategies for preventing disaster, hazard, man-made, intentional or unintentional, and supporting a lot of missions that surrounded sea burning work and just a broad scale disaster. I had a friend who I went to grad school with, and she was in the Navy, and she was at the Navy Medical Research Center, which is co-located with the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. And she said, "I got a smart friend, and you need someone who can do smart guy things to help your initiative on blast and traumatic brain injury." So they called me in for an interview, and I went and I interviewed with a doctor who at the time was Major Walter Carr. He said, "Do you know anything about blast physics? And do you know anything about traumatic brain injury?" And I said, "Well, to be honest with you, no, but I'm happy to learn." And he said, "I've never had someone try and talk me out of a job before, so that's an interesting take. And let's see how it goes." So I kind of hit the ground running, started building protocols, started immersing myself in the literature of Walter Reed, and getting as caught up as I could on the association between blast and these negative user outcomes. And coming from that social science background, I could never shake fully the idea that there was some kind of interaction between the mechanical mechanisms of blast and explosion and traumatic brain injury and the psychological consequences that are also associated with the delivery of those experiences. And that became the foundation for a lot of the research that I worked on and have been involved with ever since. And that has been a pretty fruitful endeavor. We've had a number of pieces come out looking at different facets of breacher brain, as we call it, these negative consequences of a low and moderate blast exposure over time. And we've had quite a bit of knowledge come out about the stressors of some of these blasts that are incurred in various operational theaters. And it's been a good experience.
Oh, fascinating. And what a great reminder that both soft support and trauma is always a team sport, as we like to say. So with that interesting background and focus, I'd like to move on to a couple of questions that we had after reading through your manuscript. And so our first question is, what was the origin of the idea for your study? Was it to look at increasing charge efficiency with tamping or to decrease blast effect on personnel?
So our motivation was always to decrease blast effect on personnel. That was absolutely always going to be the outcome. However, as we got to know these operational communities better, the one thing that always stood out to me, be they frontline, be they domestic law enforcement, be they part of the soft community, is they're always mission first. And they're always extremely capable when it comes to managing risk. And telling people that there was the potential for a greater health outcome long term by moderating blast exposure was not an effective mechanism for encouraging change outside of training environments. Within training environments, we'd see some modification, but not a lot. So we went to the drawing board and we looked at, well, if we can't give the operator more capability, more lethality, then we're really not supporting them the way we need to. We need to think of health as a holistic concept. And, you know, avoiding blast injury to get shot is still a pretty negative outcome. So we looked at what were the other benefits of some of the research we were doing. And one of the ones we noticed was that we could do more work with less explosive. And as we worked more and more with these communities and we were getting more fascinated with the implications of good tamping practices, we noticed that if you can lower the consequence of that blast, you can put operators closer and closer to that breaching exposure. And that means they're through their entry point and on target in less and less time. So doing more work with less boom, less energy, became a really strong driving factor in empowering them to be more mission capable. And that became probably our most major outcome, but it was not our original intended goal.
All right. Well, that's really fascinating background and always a nice reminder of what the primary mission for these types of research questions are. And our next question is, what was the reason for the small sample size of your prospective pilot study?
The reason we ended up with such a small sample size is it is extremely messy to collect data with the fidelity we need and the accuracy we need to draw any kind of meaningful conclusion. And I was, as a researcher, I was very savage with what I considered acceptable data. And when it came to consequences that affect people in the field, on mission, in training environments, working in these high-risk environments, I was not going to tolerate any data that was at all questionable. But the other side of that coin is, because of the nature of these collections, we had very little say in interdicting on some of the trainings that we were attached to collect this data. So if we were out in the field, we had set up all of our sensors, we were working on this, but then the training cadre decided that they were going to go a different direction. They were going to change a charge. They were going to do something else that was more mission relevant. We did not have the ability nor the desire to stop them from serving that need. So we ended up with a very reduced sample size over a long period of time of data that we were confident was of the quality we needed.
Well, that's fair and reasonable. Moving on, our next question for you was, how do your results compare to the wider body of literature in this area?
So the funny thing about this is, you know, if you sit down with a real seasoned breacher, someone from the community, they might sit there and say, well, we knew most of this. What they probably didn't have exact was the percentages that we would see benefit from tamping. They may not have known some of the consequences of some of these effects. And I think a lot of what we did is we provided a real point of support that people can start to evaluate and say, this is our target. We should see efficacy of this level or greater. We should see consequences of this type. And I think a lot of what we did is in line with the other research in the field, but there's frankly not much of it. And much of what exists is very operationally focused. And so what we're able to bring, and one of our bigger contributions, I believe, is to kind of give that more academic pause and academic feel to some of these things so that, you know, you can take hopefully some of these findings to a commanding officer, to a leader, and say, this is why we need to be implementing these changes, rather than just have an experienced breacher or an experienced explosive worker or an experienced person in the field say, this is what the community's moving towards, and we all feel it's the right thing. We wanted to start providing some tangible support that helps bolster those arguments and gives them some quantifiable data.
Yeah, which is such a great point. We can only make good decisions with good data, which is a great foot stomp there. And our last question for you is mostly just out of idle curiosity, my understanding that the absorbed energy from the explosive in the IV bags you used was used to transfer the water from its liquid to gas state. And I'm curious, did you see any heat injuries from the steam that was generated during these charges, or were people too far offset? And could that be a potential concern for operational use?
So I don't believe that we're going to get any kind of steam burn. I still think that if there's going to be something of that effect, it's probably going to be from the primary explosive. My gut says it's not going to be a major concern. We did not observe any. And I do think that if we look at the history of tamping, if we go back in the day to when tamps were run with 2x4s, we've seen tamping that has historically been done with rubber sheeting. We've seen tamping done with earthen materials. We've seen tamping done with old fire hose. And even if there were to be potential for scalding or burn effects, I would still take them over some of the fragmentation effects that we've seen with other tamping mediums. But the rate at which those are occurring is so low that throughout my years in the field of seeing this, I've yet to see a burn injury from a water bag that turned to steam.
Good to know. There's always the law of unintended consequences that I think is closely related to Murphy's Law as well. So always good to think about that. Well, sir, thank you so much for your time and insight. Really appreciate all of your data-driven efforts to improve warfighter health and also warfighter operation.
No, thank you. It's really something that anytime we can give the community that we serve actionable data, it's a point of personal pride. So we're grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, Josh, I think despite our best efforts, we've stumbled through yet another edition for the benefit of the three folks out there still listening to us.
Listen, my mom and dad listen, and you know, you should have at least one. You are not holding up your end of the bargain.
That's fair. For them and anybody else out there that's interested in taking a little bit of a more deep dive, just another reminder that Breakaway Media has made the three articles that we review on the podcast freely available through the website, jsomonline.org, whether you have a paid subscription or not. jsomonline.org is also your one-stop shopping for any new manuals that you may have an interest in picking up, either in hard copy or digital format, including the ATP handbook, the Pararescue Medical Operations, and the recently updated Ranger Medic Handbook.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just remember that you can go through all these articles that we went through and sort of look at our analysis, and maybe you can always provide us feedback at podcast@jsomonline.org. Let us know what you think about the podcast. Perhaps you have another take. And if you have another take, you can always reach out to us at podcast@jsomonline.org. We can always use more guest editors. Hearing from the community, hearing what they think about the literature is really important to us here at the JSON Podcast.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.